Good morning,
everybody. I would like to begin by actually thanking my Finnish colleagues. It was quite a surprise to get the invitation, especially because in the United States we so admire the Finnish educational system. And of course, I thought, what could I possibly share with my Finnish colleagues that would be of importance? And as I kept thinking about it, I realized that probably what I can share is a bit of a study in contrast. And what I know it couldn't possibly happen to you, but as you look at a future that is not devoid of tensions, it's good to contemplate what is going on in the United States, to see where you don't want to be and where, indeed, the struggle of teachers educating a wide variety of students needs to be. So, as you heard from Aija in her very nice presentation, I work with students who are in the process of developing English, and especially the academic uses of English in order to succeed in school. It's a very complex situation, and I am going to focus mainly on the education of a subset of this group who are adolescent English language learners, as we call them, and especially new arrivals. But in order to really paint a good picture of what's going on, I want to start with a little bit of demographics. In the academic year 2012-2013, English language learners constituted 9.2% of all this K through 12 education in the country. But there's been an incredible growth, because over the last 10 years, the number of ELLs has nearly doubled. So now we have 5 million students who need to learn English as a second language in American schools. And the projections are that by this academic year, we will have about 10 million English language learners. And by the year 2025, nearly 25% of our whole student population is going to be English language learners, or as the federal government calls them, limited English proficient. It's a term we don't like to use, especially because the acronym sounds LEP. And it sounds a little bit like students who have acquired a terrible illness. To complicate these issues, we see, for example, here a map of the United States. And in the dark blue color, you see states where 10% or more of the student population are English language learners. And the second dark shade of blue is 6%. It's an immense number. You may wonder why these projections that the population will double exist in a country where immigration is getting increasingly restrictive. And I really want to go there after I explore a little bit of the teacher education profession. Unlike Finland, where your teachers are highly valued and respected, in the United States, teaching is a very low-status profession. And in fact, there is a common saying in the United States that those who can learn and those who can't teach, which really goes to show what people feel about teachers in general. Furthermore, teacher education takes usually candidates, unlike Finland, with the lowest academic percentages. And we prepare teachers in 2 semesters after they have a bachelor's, and sometimes we prepare them embedded in a bachelor's program. There is also the assumption that once a teacher graduates from a university, they're done. There's no more need to learn anything anymore. And if one visits teacher education programs, most of them are very traditional, transmission-oriented kinds of courses. So you get teachers who throughout their lives have sat passively as students and who even in their teacher preparation courses keep sitting passively. So what we get is what Dan Lorty back in 1975 called the apprenticeship of observation. And it's an apprenticeship that tells them that one learns by listening to somebody talk and talk and talk. And so if you visit American classrooms, that is what happens in most of the classes. In fact, my teammates and I just completed an assessment of how English language learners are served in American, in two districts. And we found that 93% of the time, on average, teachers talk at students. And the rest, there are isolated questions that teacher asks one student, an isolated answer, and then there is the ping pong, where teachers ping questions, students ping back answers, and on occasions, teachers ping and pong themselves. So this is a very, very serious issue, which, of course, results in tremendous underperformance by English language learners. So, for example, you see here that in the year 2005, which are our most recent available figures for the National Assessment of Educational Progress, 29% of ELLs scored at or above basic level in reading, compared to 75% of non-ELLs. So the academic performance of our second language learners is dismal. And in that context, now the United States 3 years ago has mostly adopted new standards. And the new standards have been adopted that in most cases are sensible, but that in some very important cases really make little sense, especially in the education of second language learners. Furthermore, it may surprise you to hear, for example, that the two writers of the new standards for English language arts have never taught in a school and sat down in an office and wrote the standards, and then those standards go to all the teachers in the country and they have to teach. And they have a heavy emphasis on what they call reading complex texts, but complexity is mostly considered in numerical senses. So you count the lexiles in a text, and that renders a text easy or complex, when in fact we keep saying to them that that is an absurd measurement of whether a text is complex. And given the fact that 83% of our English language learners are native speakers of Spanish, in fact, words that are longer, for example, extraordinary or molecular, tend to be easier to read for students because if they see them on the printed page, they are cognates. They look exactly like those words look in Spanish. So there's a lot of misunderstanding, and the notion that if you only set up your standards higher, then immediately education will improve itself without any support for developing teacher expertise. So we are in a very difficult situation. But in that context, we believe very strongly that in spite of what our future holds for us, it is possible to really meet the future with better solutions. And I will talk about that in a minute. Projections to the year 2025, so in 10 years, tell us that the white population in the United States is going to decrease dramatically. If you look at the bottom bar, the dark blue represents 40% growth of that kind of population. And the dark orange is 40% decrease in that kind of population. So if you look at the map of the United States, The white population, the native English-speaking population, is only going to grow significantly in a few spots, right? But if you look at the projected growth of the Latino population, you see that that population is going to triple in 10 years. So there are tremendous consequences that the United States needs to really think about. If we do not offer English language learners and Latino students a robust and generative education, the future of the country is definitely going to suffer dramatically. Of course, all of this tied to a bimodal, an increasingly bimodal economy in the United States, where we talk about the 10% that has money and the 1% within the 10% that really has all the money in the country practically. And so it's a very complex context in which not only numbers, but poverty and quality of education are at interplay. Now, this is why I wanted to really work on adolescent English learners. And I want you to please just focus on the lowest bar, because that lowest bar tells us who adolescents, so middle schoolers or high schoolers, who are English language learners are. And that tells us in the whole of the United States. And the purple bar are students who are recent immigrants. So they are first generation in the United States. But the blue bar is second generation in the United States. That means their parents were the ones who migrated to the United States. But these students have been born in the United States, have exclusively attended American schools. Now they are in ninth grade, they're 15 or 14, and they still do not have academic uses of English and in their repertoire. So that's a very dramatic number. And 30% of them nationwide are third generation in the United States. So it was the generation of the grandparents, the ones that moved to the United States. Now, obviously, these students are the consequence of an educational system that is not addressing them with quality. However, that is my interpretation, and that is the interpretation of those of us who work in the field. But for many other people, there are a number of other interpretations that we need to unpack and counteract. So, the part of the solution and the kind of work that many of us do in the United States so as to turn around this situation is to reconceptualize the nature of the professionalism of teachers. Because teachers are not professional, and we say that unless teachers begin to have a strong voice and say why standards imposed by people who are not educators, by industry, basically, are not to be accepted, that can only happen if teachers really articulate what they are for, where they stand, and what theories guide their practice. So, in that sense, 4 years ago, we started a group with colleagues at Stanford University, which is called the Understanding Language Group. And it was a group that had at its task defending and proposing measures that would really develop the immense potential that all English language learners take to school. And so as part of our Understanding Language initiative, there was a conference, we developed papers, and we tried to really intervene in the policy arena to mitigate some of the damage of new standards in the education of English language learners. But at the same time, we have an initiative in which we are trying to work on professional development of teachers in which we make them aware that every time that they engage in pedagogical practices with ELLs, then these practices show that these teachers have some sort of an integrated theory of how to work with these second language learners. But that this theory, in fact, is informed by four different levels of theory. And we are going to post the presentation in your website, if you don't mind, in case anybody is interested in looking at that chart. But there are theories of second language learners that inform practice that ask, for example, what is language? How does language develop? What are the sequences in which language develops ideally? Do they exist universally, or are they very much situated in the particular needs of learners? There are theories of learning in general, which of course we want to be in contraposition to what teachers have received in their apprenticeship of observation, that say, for example, how do adolescents learn? And what is it that they learn, and what promotes their learning? What's the role of metacognition in the learning of adolescents? There are theories about the learner, and these are theories that are immensely important in the education of English language learners, because teachers many times think that these students are A, not motivated, B, are not capable, and all of that interferes in their way of engaging them, or rather, in the ways in which they don't engage them in activity that then becomes developmental in a number of ways. And finally, at least in this conceptualization, there are theories that teachers have about their own learning. And so, is their learning frozen in time and space? And many times teachers would say, I don't need to go to a workshop. I have a master's, as if when they got their master's 10 years ago, then the learning and knowledge was frozen and would work forever. I know you're all looking at me with a horrified face, because obviously that is not the way you think in Finland. But it is important to know that this is what is going on in the United States. So, for example, in terms of language, most teachers ascribe still to formal theories of language. And as we know, informal theories of language, it is formed in isolation that develops over time in sequence and supposedly builds from simpler to increasingly more complex formal structures. And some of the consequences of possessing these kinds of forms is that teachers believe there are prerequisites in order to get to study subject matter disciplinary content. And so they say, for example, those students cannot come into my class yet because their English is not at a level that would enable them to benefit from my class. And this is very problematic. It is even more problematic because, as Guadalupe Valdez pointed out in an article, then ESL, English as a Second Language courses, become curricularized. They become courses as if they were real content courses. And so students need to pass beginning ESL in order to get into an intermediate ESL course. And if not, they repeat beginning ESL. And in many cases, these beginning ESL courses are so nonsensical. Students have to, for example, conjugate verbs. When, as we are talking about second and third generation students, these students are orally proficient. They speak perfectly well. You cannot tell they are ELLs officially. The only way in which you can tell is when they're reading, when they're writing, and when they are interacting in subject matter content. So these theories are really negative because they focus exclusively on linguistic competence, but not in subject-specific communicative activities. Then there are functional theories, and what you see now is the progression that a set of standards that are the most popular set of ESL standards in the States, because we have Common Core in English language arts, Common Core standards for most states that decided to adopt them, in English language arts and in math, but in second language development, there are 7 different types of Common Core standards. So we are not united in the country because the United States is a federal country and states pride themselves on having the freedom to decide what they do educationally. So this is the most commonly used set of standards. It's called the WIDA. And you can see that, well, you cannot read, but I can tell you that the progression moves in very atomistic ways, rather than building and fostering a spiraling growth in the development of student expertise. So we are proposing, and very much following Leo Van Leer's and other people like Diane Larson Freeman's notion, that language, in fact, most profitably, is presented as action. And in this sense, language is inseparable from all many other ways of behaving that we have. So it doesn't just come out if it's oral expression in sounds, but there are body language, there's intonation, there's stress, there's rhythm, there are pointings, etc., that really build up on the communicative event. And in this view of language as action, it is not the case that form and function are disregarded, but they take a second place to being able to accomplish acts. It also proposes that language is not an autonomous system and that it really is use-based. So one apprentices into language practices as a result of being invited to participate in consequential communicative events. But if one has to conjugate verbs, then there is really no language development. And that, very importantly, in the education of the students that we work with, the ability to express oneself is also an expression of agency. Is an expression, an agency can either be nurtured or it can be diminished depending on the contextual situations in which students work in schools. And for the most part, students, especially second and third generation, feel disinvited. So, I want to now kind of point to 3 shifts that we are trying to convey to teachers of English language learners that they need to engage in. And the first one is a very important one, very simple, very totally what you do, which is that language development is not doesn't happen in one's head individually, but the language development happens as a result of participation in social events. The second one, and that's because I'm going to be showing you a little video, that language is, although it is structures and function, in reality, it is more importantly so action. And in this sense, and very consonant to other ideas I've been listening to yesterday here, it doesn't really matter initially whether one's expression is grammatically correct, but it is more important that one accomplishes the communicative acts that one is intending on accomplishing with other interlocutors or as one reads a text. And that language doesn't develop in linear ways, but and that the emphasis should not be placed on linguistic accuracy, but rather that language develops in complex, nonlinear processes, and that the goal has to be comprehension and communication. So, one final note is that we are proposing also very, very strongly that as students apprentice into disciplinary practices. They simultaneously apprentice into conceptual understandings, analytical skills, and the language required to communicate them. So they go in tandem. And this is to counteract teachers' notions that you first learn the language and then you study subject matter content. So I would like to now invite us all to visit, just for 3 minutes, the classroom of one teacher that is beginning to show these shifts. And this teacher works at the International Newcomer Academy in Fort Worth, Texas. And the students you're going to see are students who are totally new to English. In fact, this video was taken the first week in October, so students are in their fifth week of classes in English. And the teacher, Tanya Warren, is a teacher of science. They've been working on trying to study atoms, and now she has shown them a simulation and has asked them to take some notes and to ask questions. So what we're going to see is at tables of four, two students interact, taking turns, asking questions. So they're going to be asking questions about the simulation. And then the dyad is going to exchange with the other dyad their questions, and you will see what the teacher does. And let's see what we can gather about some of the shifts this teacher has engaged in as a result of her participation in professional development and her increasing questioning of how she wants to really teach newcomer students. Okay, so as we walked into Tanya's class, it is evident that Tanya has moved into many of these shifts, right? She does understand that language is action. The students don't need to be perfectly correct, and they certainly use their body language. Furthermore, these students, after only 5 weeks in an American school, they feel they have the right to speak. And they feel they have the right to be listened as well. In fact, there's a little bit of tension about that, right? It's my question. No, it's my question. Let's read my question. And so there's all of that. However, were we to see students very similar to these in the classroom of another teacher, they would be quiet, they would be silenced, and they would be corrected the moment that they begin to utter their thoughts. This teacher has a very proactive view of who her students are, because what she sees in them is the potential future to be realized as part of her task as a teacher. And she certainly knows how to scaffold the students' ability to just do just the right thing so that indeed they can then begin to own knowledge and the emergence of novelty can happen. Nobody was expecting for a team to put together all of their questions so as to have a more complex question. That is indeed what support lends it. Her own knowledge of herself as a teacher has been questioned time and time again. In fact, in the United States, we have the American Educational Research Association. We've been working with all the teachers at that school for 3 years. And this year, in April, in Chicago, she and three other colleagues presented to researchers and educators with a lot of curriculum a paper about the role of metacognition in their own development. So she does believe that teacher understanding evolves over time as a result of the kinds of supports and invitations to engage in reflection. Furthermore, this teacher has learned that scaffolding is not only a structure. She does have the structure in which dyads construct questions, then dyads exchange questions in groups of four, and then they select one question to be shared with the whole class. But that's only the structure. The structure is in place so as to be able to enable the very rich process that indeed takes place in that class. And as I said, scaffolding in this case is aimed at handing over the responsibility to learners. By the way, probably most of you got that those two students at the beginning were clarifying the fact that in Spanish, por qué means both why and because. And so that's why the girl is asking, you know, because as part of her question. But her partner certainly clarifies it. And she takes over the support that is loaned to her by her peer, as they do indeed students take over the support given, provided by teachers. I want to show you a second video, which is slightly more complex, of another teacher that has also worked on developing her students in ways that challenge her prior ways of teaching. In this Jigsaw project, students are working in groups of four, and they review how descriptions are constructed, which was something that they learned and practiced the day before in class. And primary in their discussion of description is the idea of purpose. Why do you ever engage in describing anything to anybody? The notion of painting pictures with words. Then the organization of a description. You begin by painting the background against which you're going to set up different elements that are going to be meaningful. And then teacher provides some of the formulaic expressions that really make a description flow. So students review, and then they go to four different groups. And in each of these groups, they're going to get pictures that they are going to describe following the pattern. So this is one of the pictures that one group gets. This is the picture a second group gets. This is, oops, I only have two. I don't know what happened. There should be four, but you can more or less imagine what there is. In fact, the group you're going to see describing is describing this picture. So let me see which ones are missing. Oh, a wonderful one where this boy is walking in the middle of a very crowded street market, and there are mountains in the back, and there is a bill sticking out of his pocket. So you wonder what's there. And then the other picture, he is, in the other picture, he is, one, two, three. I can't remember right now. So anyway, they go back to their base groups without the pictures. By the way, the structure has the students describe the picture together, and then teacher pulls out the picture, students rehearse, and they provide each other support. So that they say, oh, you can, you know, you can do this to signal a hat, or you can do that. So they're really encouraging each other to use body language, to use a number of supports, ecological supports, that would enable them to describe the picture well. So they are now in their base groups, and they're ready, go and describe their pictures, and the teacher now presents a new genre, a narrative. So narratives, purposes of narratives, structure of narratives, there's a character, something happens, and the character changes as a result of that. All of that is discussed, plus typical language that tends to come up in narratives. So we will now visit a very different class. And this class is in Chinatown in New York City. And the students are all Chinese. In Chinatown, I don't know if you have been to Chinatown in New York City, but it's a rather poor area of the city. And so the children here come from mainland China, and they tend to be low socioeconomic. So the teacher is Rosa Eng, and the students are at an intermediate, low intermediate level of proficiency in English. So here we see how there is a really good structure that supports students' ability to arrive at novelty and at appropriation of language that they didn't have only 40 minutes before at the beginning of class, because the task begins as a static task in which they have to describe a picture that doesn't move, but then soon becomes a dynamic task in which students just have to listen to each other's presentations and try to picture, is it the same characters I have and what are they doing now? And then it becomes an abstract task, because now they have to, together, collaboratively, assign volitions and put them in order and create a story. There is no filling the blanks, as these students would have been doing anywhere else, and there's no separation of students by levels of proficiency. It's obvious to us that some students speak more English than others, but it's also very clear that by the end of the task, everybody has written down the whole creation and everybody has to perform. And so there have been multiple instances that do not trap students into restrictions, but that in fact provide the support and the enticement so that they can move and advance. We love to film the teachers we work with, because in fact, this is, both videos are part of filming teachers every 3 months. More than filming teachers, we don't film teachers. We film more what the students do as a result of the invitations that teachers provide them. Because it is our interest to see what happens when learning is placed ahead of development, and when learning, in fact, is supported so that indeed that great potential that students bring to class can be realized. And so slices of student performance over time communicate to teachers who are non-believers what is possible in classes where indeed proleptic approaches are in place. In fact, when we work with teachers, we have them do the same activity as part of one of the examples of how scaffolding works, a structure, and then in order to facilitate this wonderful process. And it's never been the case that teachers have created stories so wonderful and compelling as the ones we just heard the students mention. And so teachers, in a way, realize our students are so competent. They are really, because first they'll say, no, they can't. No, we cannot do that. And in the States, unfortunately, there was this prevalence of the notion of the comprehensible input, which is give your students one level beyond what they understand, and that's it. And so, of course, comprehensible input makes no sense whatsoever. Even when you have students who all have the more or less the same level of proficiency, but it makes even less sense in classes that are at multiple levels of proficiency. So we try to challenge that and say that teachers need to create these construction zones where they are going to build student expertise, and that they always have to be way beyond everybody, because they need to provide multiple entry points for all students to engage in activity. And as a result of that engagement, they apprentice and they appropriate practices that they see modeled and supported by others. Now, why the interest in first-generation students for this presentation? Because I work with teachers of both first-generation, second, and third-generation. Because unless we have education like this from the very beginning, now the Chinese students you saw are in a second semester class in the United States. So then these students will really escape the luck that falls on so many that are trapped into the denomination of ELLs. Working with students who are long-term ELLs, as we call them now, is a very tough job. Because, first of all, teachers need to convince students who have been disinvited from authentic, rigorous, enticing engagement for years and years and years. They need to convince them, you do have the right to speak. I would love to listen to you. And yes, you are immensely capable. And that deconstruction is, as once again, we have multiple videos of that, is very tough at first. But once teachers develop the expertise and share stories and we share videos and deconstruct them, then we begin to really change the situation. Yesterday, I quoted to somebody my absolute favorite quote from Gramsci. But that's really where I feel our work is centered. And that is that as we look at the situation of English language learners in the United States right now, we can't help it but have pessimism of the intellect, or it was calling, but we absolutely need to have optimism of the will. And we feel that all students, but especially students who are in the process of developing English, have immense potential. And that the distance between the students today and students' future, in fact, relies on teacher expertise. And so the United States needs to invest on teacher expertise. And we always quote Finland to all of our policymakers. So please, please don't change your policies. Don't de-invest from education, because you are a wonderful standard for all of us to hold in the United States. So I'll stop here. I was so nervous yesterday. I cut lots of slides. I thought, you know, and they promised me that actually they would saw that circle. And if I stood there, I would disappear if I went over time. So the good thing is that actually there is a little bit of time for some conversation. And thank you very much once again for an invitation. You got a bad example of where things may go if you don't pay attention to, and a good example of what is possible. So thank you very much. Questions or comments?